handle the truth.
The Denise Simon Experience. The Truth Matrix. Vetting, exposing, drilling down to the truth.
Rolling Thunder, this is Hitman Ziad, over. Hitman, this is Rolling Thunder, Ziad out.
The Denise Simon Experience. Exposing politics, lies, demagoguery, spin, fraud.
Grid to suppress, Mike Charlie, 435-921. Grid to mark, Mike Charlie, 473-989er, out.
Promoting individual situational awareness. Question, probe, notice, ask why.
Mark smoke on the deck, two rounds AGPT, gas TOT 5-3.
And now, the Denise Simon Experience.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're so delighted that you decided to join us here on the Denise Simon Experience. And a big shout out to WDDQ Talk 92.1 for being gracious and generous with their airtime for the Denise Simon Experience. And along with that, we welcome Richard Lyons. Now, Richard is the author of The DNA of Democracy, Volume 1, and Shadows of the Acropolis, Volume 2. We appreciate his hard work because he is also a publisher. And with that, I think we're going to have a little bit of discussion here about the Biden administration and really what is happening over here in the Middle East. Because, ladies and gentlemen, I would argue this is not a, Hamas can be defeated, but I don't think that's going to be the end of the conflict, especially when we have protests going on just everywhere. But Richard Lyons, marching arm in arm. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you so much, Denise. It's great to be on your show.
You know, we have all of these agreements. We've got agreements with Israel, and we've got the Abraham Accords, and we have the Balfour Agreements, and, you know, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, and so forth. And I would argue that the Middle East is never, ever going to be a settled conflict, is it?
It doesn't seem so. You have, you know, the fundamental war between Israel and Arabs. And then you have the fundamental war between Shia and Shiite. And that I just think when you throw people together in a desert environment, they just, I don't know what it is. It's hatred.
I don't think Israel is telling the right story. I think they're trying to.
With regard to what, Denise?
Well, here's where I'm going to go with this. Richard, I don't think any other countries around the world has active bomb shelters. I don't think any other country has phone apps with red alerts on them that their citizens have to use. I don't think any other country has gone to battle with militant Islam as often as Israel has, and done it by themselves, I would argue. And it's not just Hamas, and it's not just Iran. It's the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. It's all of these other factions. And I think that they really need to say, this has been going on since we were created.
Yeah. Well, there's a story about the creation, and that is, you know, the persons who were indigenous in Palestine were joined by the persons who survived the Holocaust in Germany and Europe, and who survived exile from Russia, from Soviet Russia, so that the socialists wanted to remove the Jews from Russia. In addition to that, there was an immediate war. As soon as Israel was declared to exist, an immediate war with all the surrounding Arab states, which Israel won in its infancy. But upon the victory, all the Arab states combined to exile all the Jews within their countries and said, go to Israel, because there was nowhere else to go. Mm-hmm. So that is what comprises the population of Israel. It is those who survived the genocide in Germany and Poland, those who survived being exiled and losing all their property in Russia, and those who survived the war in 48-49 against the Arab states. So it's just, it's remarkable that anybody in our time can look at a state that has been attacked so often that is literally, as you said, Denise, they are surrounded by jihadists all around their borders, from Hezbollah in the north to Hamas in the south. And along their entire border, they are surrounded by persons dedicated to killing them. And no other state has ever had that situation. And for us to be ambivalent, I would argue, in our backing of Israel, our funding Iran at a time when they're funding these terrorists, I think it's unconscionable.
Richard Lyons, there's two countries that never seem to get into the debate here recently, since October the 7th. And one is Lebanon, and the other is Sinai. Now, the history of Lebanon's really quite fascinating, you know, with the Maronites and the Druze, Christians, essentially.
Yeah.
And Egypt was really Christian. Israel went to war with Egypt over Sinai and won and just said, you know what, you can keep it anyway.
Yeah, well, Egypt went to war with Israel and Israel won.
Yeah, sorry. Yes, thank
you. And gave back the Sinai after they won it.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so now the discussion is putting the Palestinians right back in Gaza after Israel gave up Gaza. I would argue that Gaza ought to be nothing. And if the Palestinians want some place to go, then go to Sinai or go to Jordan or go.
Neither the Egyptians nor the Jordanians want the Palestinians
or the Saudis or the, none of them want them.
Yeah. So now I suppose they know how Israel feels in a way.
Yeah, precisely. So why has it always been Israel's problem to fix?
It seems to me that, you know, one quarter of the globe almost is controlled by Muslim majority countries, and this little sliver on a beach in Palestine, it consumes the whole place. It's very it's remarkable.
I watched a video this morning, Richard Lyons, of what Gaza used to be before 2005 when Israel gave it up. And it was a wonderful place. It was a resort. It had beautiful buildings. It had beaches. It had cafes and shops. And
you mean it was just like Lebanon before the terrorists took that over?
Yes. So that is really part of the other story that Israel is not telling. I mean, come on, Israel.
It can be argued, Denise, that Arabs live better under Israeli rule.
Yes.
And are more represented in Israel than they are anywhere else. Because of the democratic institutions that Israel has.
So this tells us that we're going to necessarily have to turn back to finger pointing at all things United Nations. Is there some truth to what I just said?
Well, I think the United Nations has been taken over by the very
radicals
entity. Yes, the entities that the United Nations was created to control. It's the League of Nations didn't work, and the United Nations doesn't work. It's been overtaken by persons with anti-democratic views. There are two parts of the world. There's that which is, and this is the reason I wrote the DNA of Democracy, Denise. It's all about the difference between free societies and tyranny. And the difference, there's a great gulf between them. And what we should have is a United Nations dedicated to the rights of humanity. And those countries which want to be a part of that have to have certain institutions which create rights.
The Trump administration defunded or and stopped paying dues, if you will, to peace parts of the United Nations. And this administration, the Biden administration, seems to be following in lockstep, because it was the under pressure of the United Nations that the Biden administration took the Houthis off the terror list when the Trump administration put them on. They weren't on there very long.
Yes.
So how bad would it be if we just, you know, in coming months, if with a with our own regime change, if it happens, when it happens, that we essentially financially dismantle the United Nations?
I again, I think it's been handed over at our expense to the persons who don't agree with our mindset as pertains to human rights. So if Russia, you know, if Russia and Iran, they're talking about Iran
on the Human Rights Council,
heading up the Human Rights Council. They are the biggest offenders of it, of human rights on Earth. October 7th is the key example of that. And here we have a Biden/Obama administration that is funding Iran. Mm-hmm. They fund everything that I just read an article of yours, Denise, that that China is enslaving 40,000 children in the Congo in order for them to mine cobalt and lithium for batteries. Now, who's funding those batteries? And where are the human rights in that quest? This is green energy money funneled through our government that's funding slavery in the Congo.
Well, and thank you for bringing that up, because interestingly enough, when Qatar built the huge stadium for the World Cup, who do you think the workers were, the construction workers were, the majority of them? They were North Korean slaves.
My gosh.
Living in...
And it's right in front of our face. And,
yes.
And here we have marches about slavery that existed 200 years ago here. And we were the only country to fight slavery at the cost
of our
own
blood. And those poor North Koreans lived in horrible conditions building those stadiums, plural. But beyond that, they didn't even get to keep all of their paychecks. Their paychecks had, 2/3 of their paychecks had to go back to the North Korean government.
As that will tell you, there's the difference right there. There's the difference right there. That is a lack of human rights and existing under a tyranny.
And so if I was to say that the world has lost its equilibrium, I don't think I'm being hyperbolic. And I think that the United Nations is really the billboard for the lack of equilibrium.
I think
about right?
I think you're. Well, equilibrium implies that there is equal liberty on one side in the world, and
or balance,
and tyranny on the other. I think we lack a moral clarity in our own country because our leaders, such as Joe Biden and Barack Obama, are continuously attacking the institutions that made this country free, and so. They attack the Constitution. They attack our representation. They attack localities and states such as Arizona, which simply wants to defend itself against these hordes of immigrants coming in.
Texas,
You can't call them immigrants. They are an invading force.
Of insurgency.
Foreigners. Yes. It's not insurgency. It's invasion.
Well,
of a foreign, of millions of persons who were not born in this country. And it is, I think, to further dilute the belief in this country and our own institutions.
Our own military, our Pentagon, talks about battlefields and places that are ungoverned spaces. Libya was an ungoverned space. I would argue still is. Syria. But you know what's really ungoverned is something that's right here in our backyard, and that's Mexico.
Yeah.
It's completely ungoverned, and I can't get anybody to say that, admit
well, they,
that.
I think they have a government that is in league with the cartel of gangs, drug cartels down there. They know that, you know, they're like a serpent that's intertwined with this, with the drug cartels, and they can't make a move because the drug cartels menace their lives and their families' lives. It's like the mafia.
Let me switch back to China here for a second, because there was a time, and it's still going on, I would argue, that there was organ harvesting that was going on in China. Remember that one?
Yeah, that's very hard.
Well, I'm hearing now, Richard Lyons, that the drug cartels, rather than asking these migrants for money, for the mules to move them north, they could be, and from whatever country, by the way, whether it be, you know, from Mexico or China or Senegal, if you give up an organ, we'll give you credit. Like if you give up one of your eyes, you get a credit of $15,000. Now, that almost tells me that the, and proven so even more, that the cartels are in bed, obviously, with China because of fentanyl. But I think it's been taken a step further now with organ trafficking.
Yeah, it's I had not heard or read that, but that's horrific.
But and there again, makes sense,
you
wouldn't
know,
it?
You have to. There has to be everything we've touched on that has been brought up has to be treated with moral clarity. There are human rights, and there's an invasion of those rights. There are institutions given to liberty, and there is crumbling such institutions in countries like Mexico, where drug cartels are ruling the day, and where, yeah, this infusion of fentanyl is killing up to 100,000 people, mostly young people, in America.
It's poison.
Every year. It is poison. And here we have an administration who their every effort is to maintain an open border. Not only are they not executing the laws as per our Constitution, standing laws about immigration and defending our southern border, they are making every effort to do the opposite. Now, whom does this serve if it's not the drug cartels? And then when the fentanyl makes its way with the cartels, not to mention the human slavery and trafficking, sex slavery going on, that's going to all the major urban areas. They've defunded the police in those cities so that they cannot contain the illegality going on in those cities. It's simply impossible. So you have an administration running this country that is allowing this to happen, and it's allowing a type of slavery. And that is because all these people, these millions of people that are coming in here, they don't have any redress to go to the government and say, I want my rights observed. They can only go to the cartels who are now running the gangs of American cities and say, oh, just please don't beat me. Please don't imprison me. Please don't kill me. And if somebody dies on a city street in San Francisco under the control of the cartel, who knows it? This is what has me angrier than any other thing, is that not only do they attack the Constitution, they are undermining the security of American citizens by what they're doing these days.
Well, you know, Richard Lyons, we've got a breakdown of law and order, not only here in the United States, but globally. And
yeah, it's moral clarity and character.
Do you remember when the Wendy's burned down in Atlanta? That kind of started off a lot of the BLM kind of thing?
Yes, I do.
Okay, well, here's a fact. Two people, Chisholm Kingston and Natalie White, those were the two people that have been charged with burning down the Wendy's in Fulton County, Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah.
So, what's their consequence? A $500 fine and 150 hours of community service and 5 years of probation.
Yeah, and that conflagration went through 200 American cities.
Yes.
BLM. And
yes.
Nobody does, and you know, it just hollows out. They think they're helping the poor. This does not help the poor to to ransack retailers who are paying the taxes that keep city governance afloat. You're not helping people by bringing the fentanyl trade into every urban area in America. How is this helping? You're not helping when you burn down your own neighborhoods. It's nefarious.
This is symbolic of what is happening.
Utterly wrong.
You know, nobody's above the law. Well, you know, I would say arson is a felony and not a misdemeanor where you're just going to, you know, pay a $500 fine. But that's indicative of how we're collapsing here. Civil society is collapsing here, but it's collapsing globally. Yeah. We can see that from the protests that are going on in the streets, in big cities, college campuses. You know, I'm a little afraid, Richard Lyons, of any stoppage of this. There's no incentive to stop some of these things unless you can get speakers to go to these places and say, let's put these truths in some out there and put some things in context. But these places won't even allow the speakers to show up. Correct?
That's true, too. And you know, when you say no one is above the law, what we've been talking about here is, you know, the persons at the highest places in our federal government ignoring the Constitution, which demands the fair and common execution of the law. That's right at the top. And they will not defend the border, though we have laws in place.
Or decisions coming out of the Supreme Court.
I'm not sure where that comes from.
Well, the student loan thing.
What reference are you making, Denise?
On the student loans. They said, the Supreme Court came out and said, you know, you can't cancel student loans, and this administration is defying the Supreme Court.
Yeah, so that's exactly why I wrote Shadows of the Acropolis. So the DNA of democracy is all the how and why we were put together. The Shadows of the Acropolis is everything that the Democrat Party has done for the past 100 years in defiance of the Constitution. And it's quite a read. And it is. It's a breakdown of law and order. It's first a disrespect to the law and then an absolute defiance of the law, such as we had, you know, in the Obama administration when they were the IRS was attacking the Tea Party movement and the FBI was attacking reporters for not reporting what the Obama administration approved. These are all symptoms of the same disease. It's the disease of socialism. It's the disease of tyranny. And it's getting rooted in our country.
Touche. I would argue that the fix is not going to be a easy one, and it's not going to be one that's quick. I think it's going to take us probably maybe up to somewhere between 5 and 10 years to, you know, go back to the early 90s at a minimum, or maybe even back to, I don't even want to say the 60s, because that was a little shaky, but maybe back to the 50s, yes?
Well, it just takes a renewal of our belief in the manner in which we were founded, a renewal in the ideals of our common liberty being more valuable than anything else to everybody. So you have to devote yourself to that, like the Revolutionary generation did, like the Civil War generation did. You have to recognize our common liberty and common law is to be held above everything else, whether it's a little money from the cartel, whether it's your love of Iran. I mean, where the hell does that come from? I just don't get it.
I think between Israel and Hamas is kind of a jumping off point. I think that we should be able to take that and run with it and show all the lanes kind of the consequences of having these the lack of law and order, the lack of decency and policy. And that's why we get that's why poor Israel got what they got. I mean, they're victims again. And we little guys out here are victims too. But
if there was ever a moment for moral clarity,
here it is.
That's it. Exactly, Denise.
Richard Lyons, The DNA of a Democracy in the Shadows of Acropolis. Thank you, Richard, for carving out some time to be with us.
Oh, thank you, Denise, for having me on.
So please. And ladies and gentlemen, there's more coming your way. Stay with us.
When it comes to making plans, you are the best. What about those round trips that you plan in advance, which are perfect on your way there and perfect on your way back? Or those meetings with friends for which you make a group chat 3 months before so that nobody or anything is missing? Or your daughter's first birthday party? You planned it with such dedication that instead of the first, it felt like our quinces. The same way you plan each detail for those moments. Start planning to protect you and your loved ones from a natural disaster. Sign up for local weather and emergency alerts. Prepare an emergency kit and make a family communications plan. Protecting your family is the best plan you can make. Get started at ready.gov/plan.
Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're so pleased that you stayed with us here on the Denise Simon Experience. Steve Gorman has been kind enough to accept the invitation to join us once again. He's the Executive Director of Climate Science Coalition of America. He's the author of several books, I think 4 books, related to energy and climate change and sustainable development and all of that stuff. But we have an event going on in the Middle East called COP 24 or something? I forget.
COP 28.
28. Thank you. Thank you, Steve, and thanks for being with us.
Great to join you, Denise. Yeah, the 28th Conference of the Parties. This is now 28 years they've been doing this since about 1995. And the conferences get bigger and bigger and demand more and more things from people. And just an event. It's actually probably now the largest carbon dioxide emitting event of the year.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that there are some people that are beginning to push back on all this climate change stuff. Is that right? Are you seeing a little bit of that?
There's some early indications of a breakdown here in the drive for net zero, which is about what my book is about, Green Breakdown. I thought it was going to take about a decade or so, but there's a bunch of things going on. And there does seem to be a lot of pushback. Robert Bryce, who's an energy expert, points out that there are many rejected wind and solar systems in the United States now, more than 100 in this last year. The local folks are saying we really don't want these things. Off the East Coast, we've had about half of the offshore wind systems pull out at large penalties because they're not able to make a go of it with the interest rates so high, and so those have gone down. There was just an auction in the United Kingdom a couple of weeks ago for onshore wind, and they had no bidders because they couldn't do it at the price. Well, now the UK government's going to raise the price by 70%, so go figure that. But we also have a electric vehicle speed bump that has occurred. We can talk about that if you like. The demand for electric vehicles seems to be faltering.
It's collapsing. Mm-hmm.
And then we have all of these renewable stocks have really been crunching for the last 2 years or so. Hydrogen stocks and EV stocks and wind and solar, and so there's a lot of indications that the drive for net zero is really having its problems.
Well, you know, I've often asked, and this goes back to the Obama administration, we were throwing hundreds of millions and millions of dollars to all things climate change, and I would argue, what are the deliverables? Where are the receipts that there's something of significance that these just billions of dollars have achieved? And
absolutely right. Yeah. Yeah. The drive for this climate thing is like building a hospital and never serving a patient, or raising an army and never taking a hill.
All this money
is spent, but nobody ever says, well, if we spend this money, global temperatures will be lower by this, or the storms will be less frequent, or or less.
Oceans will recede.
Right, the oceans will stop rising. So there never is a deliverable. You're right. It's just it's an ideology, and there's an endless stream of things we need to do. I mean, John Kerry at the COP 28 was just saying we need to ban all coal plants worldwide.
Worldwide. Mm-hmm.
There are about 4,000 of those that are operating today, and they provide the largest share of electricity globally. And so he would rather have people not have electricity. We have an electricity shortage across the world. We have about 700 million people that are not connected to the electrical grid. We have another 2 billion that are, but they have daily blackouts. So a third of the world either is not connected or has daily blackouts. We literally have hundreds of hospitals in the developing nations that do not have electricity. I mean, try and run a hospital without electricity. That's an almost impossible thing. Yet, you know, Mr. Kerry flies to the conference in his private jet and tells everybody what they need to do. We don't need coal plants, and we don't need people to have electricity is the effective message. So very, very sad.
Well, he has tried very hard. He, John Kerry, has tried very hard to connect himself to China and made a lot of trips there. And he tells us he's making progress. Yet China continues to build coal plants.
Well, they do, and China is smart. They have a lot of people that need to raise their standard of living as well. They have about 2,363 coal plants is a number that I've got from somebody here. Around the world, we're building about 1,000 new ones, either in planning or in building. So coal is not going away in the short term. Coal has some issues. It has some issues with real pollutants. Nitrogen oxides and carbon oxides and particulates, those sorts of things. But if you don't have electricity, then you're not so concerned about those issues.
Yeah.
And as nations get wealthier, then they will clean up their act with real pollutants, and they will reduce those, and their air will get cleaner again. I mean, the United States is a perfect example. As I mentioned I don't know if I mentioned on your show in the past, but my grandfather had a coal furnace in his basement in the 1950s. And in Chicago, every year after it, every time it would snow in the winter, after about 4 or 5 days, you'd have a black layer on all of the snow. You could see it. It was coal dust. And the young folks don't know what spring cleaning was for. In spring cleaning, they would literally wash down the inside of all of the walls in the houses to remove the coal dust. That happened every spring. But then we got natural gas, and if you put natural gas in for either a home that uses a wood-burning furnace or a coal furnace, you reduce particulate levels by a factor of 1,000. So our air is very much cleaner than it was in the 1950s. Particulates are probably down about 98%. And so this is the thing that nations do as they get wealthier. And so these coal plants will probably eventually be phased out. A lot of the coal plants now are very clean. They have a lot of scrubbers on the back end and those sorts of things. But the place where we've really gone off base is the idea that carbon dioxide is a pollutant and that we have to get rid of that. That is just really a false ideology. We need to clean up real pollution, but not carbon dioxide.
Well, December the 4th at the COP 28 is also Gender Day.
Uh-oh.
So, yeah, Steve, what does Gender Day have to do with COP 28?
I don't know. I really don't want to get into the gender issue. I'm not.
I'm
not
just throwing it out there.
I'm not an expert there, but let's talk about COP 28 a little bit. So, this has been going on for as I say, 28 years now, and we have all the big dignitaries there, King Charles III and Bill Gates and John Kerry. Pope Francis was not able to make it because of health issues, I guess, but many other dignitaries. They're expecting 70,000 attendees this year. And these originally, 25 years ago, they were getting about 5,000 a year. Now it's 70,000. And so these people fly in. This is in Dubai, in the United Arab Emirates. They fly in on either public commercial jets or private jets.
Mm-hmm.
And when you burn jet fuel, you emit 3 pounds of carbon dioxide for every pound of fuel that you burn. And so all of these trips are emitting large amounts of carbon dioxide. Then when they get there, they get into limos or they get into taxis and drive from the airport. Or they might even get in an electric vehicle, but the electric vehicles in UAE, 82% of the electricity comes from natural gas. And at the conference, they're going to push for the end of the use of hydrocarbon fuels, such as coal, oil, and gas. Fatih Birol, who is there, the executive director of the International Energy Agency, he said in 2021, quote, if governments are serious about the climate crisis, there could be no new investments in oil, gas, and coal from now on, from this year. But those conference attendees will all have cell phones, which are made from plastic that comes from oil and gas. They'll be wearing suits and ties and shoes and other clothing. And most of that comes from synthetic fibers from hydrocarbons. They're going to dine on food, which is produced by farms that use synthetic nitrogen fertilizer that was created from ammonia that was produced from natural gas. Or in the case of China, they produce it from coal. And hydrocarbons drive our modern society. So this is hypocritical to the nth degree. They're really not having any effect on global temperatures or energy or anything else with these annual conferences.
I would say here at this point that Europe is probably the one region of the globe that is most challenged by all things climate change, oil, natural gas, transportation, heat, and that kind of thing. So I think that they're probably well represented at COP28. Would that be a true statement?
They are the well representative. Well, they've just gone through what I call as a transnational energy breakdown, if you're transnational energy shock. And we're going to see more of these the more that our leaders push us toward intermittent wind and solar, which really can't do the job. But electricity prices are roughly triple what they were 2 years ago. Natural gas is up 2.5 mm-hmm. times in Europe. And their usage of natural gas is about down about 18%. Well, the International Energy Agency says they're being a lot more efficient. But in the same article that the International Agency wrote, they said people are going to bed early to stay warm in England and in Northern Europe, and they're putting newspaper up on their windows for insulation. To me, that's not being efficient. That's a loss of a standard of living. And this idea that we can live on intermittent wind and solar and imported natural gas, which can be very expensive, rather than producing our own, which they could be doing in Europe, is just crazy policy. And they all think that we can stop the oceans from rising if we do these sorts of things. I want to talk a little bit more about the COP conference, if you'll
please.
Let me.
Please, yeah, please.
So if you look at the evidence of what all these conferences have done, there's no evidence that they've had any effect.
Right.
The carbon dioxide has been rising now since about 1958, very steadily. It fluctuates every year, but it's been going up. It's actually been going up faster during all this era when we've had these COP conferences. And if you look at energy consumption globally, global energy consumption has tripled since 1965, and it has accelerated since about the year 2000. And over the last 20 years, the world has spent about $5 trillion to promote renewable energy, and we've installed more than 300,000 wind turbines worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
But in 2021, coal, oil, and natural gas still provided 81% of the world energy consumption. That's the same percentage as in 1999. So all of these COP conferences really can be regarded as pointless or futile. They're really not doing anything. Oh, by the way, as I mentioned, the biggest thing that's happening is the attendance has risen from 5,000 people a year to 70,000. So, and if we all live long enough, we may see a COP 50. And gee, I can't imagine how many people will be going to one of those. But I mean, it just is really pointless, and it's all based on the misguided idea that if we all drive electric vehicles, we could stop the oceans from rising. If we build wind turbines everywhere, we can make the storms less frequent and less severe. If we change light bulbs, we can save polar bears. This stuff ought to be regarded as modern superstition.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned light bulbs, because, I mean, we are changing up to LEDs. I guess I'm okay with that. I don't know.
Well, they're pretty good. They're not so expensive now.
Yeah. I mean,
they're better than the fluorescent ones.
I just bought something that said it'll cost me $1.49 to run these LEDs a year. Okay, I can deal with that. So I don't turn off the light switch quite as fast as I used to. But we have all of these alternative sources. We've got wind and we've got solar. And so if we're using the alternatives or more of the alternatives, then you would think that the price of power itself, electrical power, would come down because you're consuming less. And I would argue the power companies are going, it's hurting us, and so we're going to have to charge more. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's one of the things that's going to cause a green breakdown. Green energy, and by the way, we'll just try to make a transition to net zero by 2050. And by the way, I should say the wealthy nations of the world are trying to do this. The United States, Europe, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and a few others want to get rid of all coal, oil, and natural gas, replace it with wind, solar, and biofuels by 2050. And you're right. One of these things that this causes is higher electricity prices, higher energy prices. A perfect example is California. California has now passed New England and become the second most expensive electricity state in the country beside Hawaii. And they're at 26 cents a kilowatt hour. The national average is about 15, so they're paying about 80% more.
Mm-hmm.
And they are very green, right? They have a lot of solar and they have a lot of wind. And their prices are going to go much, much higher too. A rate increase was just approved for Pacific Gas and Electricity. But the big problem with these intermittent renewables, wind and solar, is as you install them and you're trying to get to a higher level of renewable penetration, you have to keep around all the existing power plants, the ones that you can turn on when you need mm-hmm. them, the coal mm-hmm. and the gas and in some cases the nuclear as well. And so you end up building a whole new set of plants, all the renewables, and you keep 90% of the old ones around, and so your prices go way, way up. And, you know, the bad news is if you don't do this, then you start seeing power outages.
Steve,
that can be very bad. Go ahead.
I'm struggling with something here.
Yeah.
We have an awful lot of, I would say, billions of acres across the globe that is just sand. It's desert. And it's useless. I mean, it's... You can't inhabit it. You can't live there. There's nothing there. Why are not these solar farms on these desert areas?
Well, there have been some talk about that. And California has blanketed some areas, too, with pretty big solar systems. Europe also has a plan to take the Sahara Desert in North Africa and cover it with solar and ship it up to Europe. One of the problems with these is they're usually in remote areas. They're not where people are living. It's not like you build a power plant a couple miles away. And so you have losses when you build all of this. The other thing is you put these in the deserts, and what happens? Well, the sand blows over them and the dust blows over them. They're not really maintenance-free. And they're just very expensive. They require vast amounts of land. When I speak to groups, I like to say, well, you know, what makes, what's more environmentally friendly? A system that uses one unit of land to produce one unit of electricity, or a system that uses 100 units of land to produce one unit of electricity? And, you know, the obvious answer is the one that uses a lot less land. Well, those tend to be, a guy by the name of Vaclav Smil has written a book on this where he looked at all the land area used for all of these electricity sources, and he found that the ones that were efficient, that used about one unit of land for one unit of electricity, was nuclear and coal and natural gas. But solar comparatively uses more than 100 units of land to produce that one unit of electricity on average. Wind even uses more if you count all of the area that it covers, and biofuels also is very, very bad. So if not for the ideology of climatism and the fear of man-made warming, nobody would be considering these systems environmentally friendly. They just, and that's why, as I mentioned, we're getting these many locals are now pushing back against the installation of wind and solar, and and those things are not being approved. They just take so much area to put in into place.
Well, I'm glad you kind of mentioned that, because, you know, here on the upper Atlantic coast, we're finding that these, you know, offshore wind farms are killing whales. And there's very few people that are reporting on that, although there are some that certainly are. Okay, so that's happening in the, you know, upper part of the Atlantic here. Is it happening that you have seen, Steve Gorham, any other parts of the globe, or they're not?
Well, I should qualify that a little. I think in England they're having some issues with whales washing up on shore too. The biggest areas around New Jersey, I think they've had like 20 whales in the last year that have washed up on shore, which is a big increase. And it is—it's still a theory, but to put in these wind turbine systems, they use sonar to survey the bottom of the ocean, and so they're pinging it with the solar and so the sonar, and whales use that as well. So they think they're following them up, and you know, a lot of people argue that is not the case, but it looks like that is kind of an issue. I think almost a bigger issue for these. And by the way, some people have been proposing. Offshore wind in your area in the Gulf of Mexico, and I'm
leave me alone.
I think this is bad idea. My wife and I live part time in Virginia Beach, and we have a system going in off the coast of Virginia Beach as well. I don't think these things are going to survive. Now in Europe they do a lot of this, but they don't have hurricanes. We have hurricanes.
Yes.
And these wind systems are designed to protect themselves. They change the blade angles and they turn in directions that will protect the blades when the wind gets too strong. The problem is, though, in a hurricane, when you get close to the eye, the winds are very, very strong and they're very, very erratic. They change direction very, very fast. And I think there's some evidence that these wind systems will not be able to turn. They'll not be able to yaw fast enough. And so I think they're going to be destroyed when you get a big hurricane here. And for example, in Virginia Beach, we get one every 20 or 30 years that comes by. And then these systems are just going to be knocked out. And I hope the ratepayers don't end up paying for these things. But, you know, there's just a lot of issue with this. And the idea that we have to put wind offshore everywhere, intermittent wind, and then we have to back it up with expensive batteries so that we can stop the oceans from rising or the planet from warming, that is... it's just way, way off base, and it is going to break down, and eventually we're going to get back to low-cost, reliable energy.
Well, Steve Gorham, you know, I'm glad you mentioned hurricanes, because I'm looking at this COP28 thing, and one of the sessions says climate action. So with the billions of dollars that's been thrown at climate change and climate action, why hasn't there been a study to figure out how to, I mean, we can predict the tornadoes and we can predict the hurricanes, and hurricanes, we get a lot of warning and we can, you know, track their paths. So why haven't we figured out a way to destroy a hurricane before it causes, you know what I'm saying? Before it causes colossal damage.
They're pretty big and powerful. They're pretty big and powerful.
Can you imagine throwing $100 billion at figuring out how to stop a hurricane or make it from a Category 5 down to a 1?
It's kind of like trying to stop the lightning. Someone had talked about how much energy is in a hurricane. A big one, it's like hundreds of hydrogen bombs. I mean, they're very, very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
The good news is, though, that all these articles that talk about how hurricanes are getting stronger and more frequent are just flat out wrong.
Sure they are.
This year, it's actually been a very low hurricane year. We've had one hurricane come ashore in the United States. That was Hurricane Idalia that came across the panhandle in Florida near your area. It was a Category 3. And President Biden got on the TV that very same day and said, well, this is due to the climate. But we've had about 300 hurricanes come ashore in the United States since 1850. And back about 1900, we were getting about two a year on average. about 20 a decade, two a year. But that has been declining a little bit over the last 100 years. Now we're getting about, on average, about 1.5 hurricanes a year that come ashore. So they've actually, the incidence of hurricanes coming ashore has actually been declining slowly for about 150 years. And if you look globally, the numbers are fairly flat. You don't see an increase in number of either tropical storms or stronger hurricanes. And we don't see more tropical storms turning into stronger hurricanes, which would be happening if storms are getting stronger. So the data doesn't support the alarm. The best thing we can do is adapt to hurricanes and rising seas. We need to build seawalls. And in the Caribbean, where their houses aren't very strong, they need to get wealthier as nations, and they need to build concrete structures. That is the best way, boosting the wealth of nations, building strong buildings. That is the best way to reduce hurricane damage, not think that you can drive electric cars and we're going to make the hurricanes disappear. That's just goofy thinking.
Well, at the COP28, they're talking about how they have something called the Adaptation Fund. And there are several countries or leaders that have pledged big money, and their target this year is $500 million.
Yeah. $500 million. You know, they were just scolding the Biden administration, who pledged $17 million, I think, and they thought that was all too small. You know, it is really goofy. Much of this is done to keep the developing nations in the game. If you look at developing nations, they need coal, oil, and natural gas. Renewables provided only a very tiny part of the energy consumed in developing countries last year. Africa, only 2.4% of their energy was from renewables. India, 5.9%. The Middle East, only 0.7% of their energy. Southeast Asia, 6.3%. You're not going to solve the problem of these hundreds of hospitals not having electricity by putting up solar and wind.
No.
And so, but what they're doing is they're offering loads of money to all of the developing nations to try and be green. They want to transfer money from the United States, Europe, and others. Matter of fact, in 2021, India demanded $1 trillion per year. They said, send us $1 trillion a year and we will get to net zero by 2070.
Yeah.
So you know, I understand all that, but you know, it doesn't make any sense. These nations need they need reliable energy, low cost energy, so they can bring up the standard of living of their people, as we did for many, many years, and as Europe did. And then we also need to install scrubbers and work on the real pollutants, but again, not carbon dioxide.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what the readouts are when COP28 is over, and see how much money we throw at it, and see what kind of timelines, and see what the deliverables are or the expectations are. Because I return on investment, I don't see any. I just don't see any, except for heartache. We can't have gas stoves. We can't have gas lawnmowers.
Yep.
So
it's crazy. So people need to push back, and I would recommend they get a copy of Green Breakdown. It's a color paperback. There's a cartoon in front of each chapter. There are 150 color sidebars with crazy things like the New York Times author who said that we all ought to mate with shore people to control global warming. Figure that one out.
Don't eat meat anymore.
But it's available at Amazon, of course. There are ebooks as well. I will send them a signed copy if they go to my website, Steve Gorham, GOREHAM.com. And they need to read this if they've got a gasoline vehicle or a stove, or they use electricity even, and push back on our political leaders. And as you say, what is this really going to do for the climate? The answer is not a whole lot. So.
Green Breakdown, Steve Gorham. Thank you so much for all of this and keeping pace with what is happening. Good job, and we appreciate
the
time.
Thank you, Denise.
Until the next time. Ladies and gentlemen, that's right. There's more coming your way, ladies and gentlemen. Stay with us.
the conversation starter. This is Talk 92.1 WDDQ 8L Valdosta.